Retreat at Spirit Rock, a week-long New Year's Eve retreat that I teach each year. And it's still pretty much with me. And even though maybe New Year's Eve seems far away for some of you by now, I wish you all a Happy New Year. And one of the things I usually teach or say at New Year's Eve is that New Year's Eve doesn't exist. And most people, I think, in the audience relax when they hear that. They're relieved. Since they're, you know, at a retreat where nothing happens anyway, sometimes they want to be there because they get away from all the places where something does happen. But New Year's Eve doesn't exist. It's a very interesting, you know, you can easily point that out. I mean, it exists certainly as a convention that we all share. But it doesn't really mark anything real in the world, concrete in the world. It doesn't mark the astronomical phenomena. There are other astronomical phenomena around this time which are more interesting than, you know. I think that someone said the 3rd of January is when the sun is closest, furthest from the...
Closest.
What?
Closest. The Earth is closest.
The Earth is closest to the sun on the 3rd of January. Was. Bye, we're going away. So it doesn't really mark anything special. It's just a convention that some various confused Romans and confused Roman Catholics came up with as a time to celebrate the change of the year. And there's a lot of confusion, as we know, built into the new year, the idea of it, the fact that some Christian cleric some 1700 years ago or so decided the calendar should begin with the year one rather than the year zero. And so now we've been arguing back and forth whether it should be 2000 or 2001, the change of the millennium. Also, not only are we confused about when the millennium is supposed to change, we're also confused about our months. Most of you probably don't think, I don't know if you realize that we're completely confused about this last 4 months of the year. Because December literally means in Latin the 10th month. And November is the 9th month, and October the 8th, and September is the 7th month. So not only don't we really mark anything real on New Year's Eve, but we also don't... we're confused about what we are saying when we do say it. So I kind of give a talk like this. Maybe it's a little bit cute on New Year's Eve. But mostly I do it to point out how much we live in the world of conventions. And that New Year's Eve is a convention that we in the Christian-influenced world have adopted, and now it's become the whole world. It's kind of, we don't call it the Christian era anymore. We call it the common era. But it's a convention we share, and much of our world is convention. But it's useful occasionally to point out what is a convention, and therefore, in a sense, arbitrary, and what is maybe concrete and real in some other way. And for Buddhists, this is a very essential issue, because the world of convention is actually, for Buddhists, understood to be most of the world we live in. The sense of self, the idea of self we have, the way we represent ourselves to the world, is understood to be a convention that we often take to be fixed. And so we hold on to that fixed notion, or we defend it, or we try to change it, or we get involved in ways that cause us much suffering. And people can spend a lot of time in the world of conventions, trying to adjust it, trying to change it. They don't like one convention, so they try another one out. Or they try to change it, or they like one particular convention and try to hold on to it and not make it change at all. And we can spend a lot of time in the world of our conventions, in the world of our ideas, trying to shore them up, trying to change them or whatever. And it isn't that it's unuseful to do that, or inappropriate to do that always, but to expect that that's going to provide us with full liberation. Buddhists will argue it's like rearranging the furniture on the Titanic. You can change the furniture around, but the Titanic's still going to go down. And that what Buddhism is ultimately pointing towards is something which is unconventional. So that immediately makes it unpopular, because we want, you know, we don't want anything unconventional in our local neighborhood. But the unconventional, so to get some sense of what the unconventional is a very important part of what Buddhist practice is aiming at. Now, the unconventional aspect of Buddhist practice is not easy to understand, and also not necessarily so popular. And one of the reasons for this is that the unconventional aspect of liberation, the unconventional aspects of the mind, which we can discover, seem to have no obvious practical value. So why would you be interested in something that has no practical value? Many of us are very interested in, you know, what's in it for me? What can it provide me? What can it do for my society? What good will it provide the people around me? There's a lot of suffering and I want to help them. And so we want conventions, we want ideas, we want things that are obviously efficacious, efficient, practical, useful. And the unconventional can appear to be, I don't know if unpractical is the right word, but can appear to have no real efficacy or role in the world of conventions. And in that, many of us base much of our security in the world of conventions. The unconventional can be frightening. And people say, you know, well, I don't want to get close to that because I don't want to lose my security in whatever security you have. When the Buddha was, in one of the few descriptions in the early Buddhist discourses, one of the few ways in which the Buddha described his quest for enlightenment before he was enlightened, he says that as a young man, he reflected that he was subject to sickness, old age, and death, and that he thought that it was probably inappropriate for him, that he was subject to sickness, old age, and death, to seek for security, peace, happiness in that which is also subject to sickness, old age, and death, that which is impermanent, that which just changes and passes away. So he said, well, instead of pursuing that, I'm going to pursue happiness or well-being or liberation in that which is unchanging, that which is unailing, that which is unaging, that which is deathless. And deathless became a very important key term for Buddhists, for this unconventional reality, the deathless. And so the Buddha said, since I'm subject to sickness, old age, and death, I'm going to pursue that which is not subject to sickness, old age, and death. And perhaps this was the philosophy of a very young, idealistic man, person. But in any case, it gave him the inspiration to go pursue something that was outside of convention, outside of what was normal in society. Then, in the night of his enlightenment, or after he was enlightened, he decided not to teach. He thought that there was no one in the world who would really understand what it is he had discovered. And so he then decided not to teach. And some scholars feel that part of the reason for this is that the model of student-teacher, teacher-student teaching in ancient India for people who had discovered the kind of essential spiritual truths as the Buddha had was a model of virtually of secrecy, that the Brahmanical teachers would often impart their spiritual knowledge to their sons only, or they had imparted to a very select group of disciples who studied with them for years and years. So it's possible the Buddha was kind of a little bit influenced by the model around him to be reluctant to teach. But then, as the myth goes, the great god Brahma came to the Buddha and said, oh, please beat the drum of the deathless. Please give the teachings of the deathless. There are people in the world who have but little dust in front of their eyes, and they will be able to understand what you have to teach. So the Buddha then surveyed all the people he knew, or surveyed the world, and he decided, in fact, there were people in the world who would understand if he tried to teach them. And then he announced that he would teach, and that the doors of the deathless are open. So in his quest for awakening, the Buddha was seeking for the deathless. Here was a person who was subject to sickness, old age, and death, and that's something which all of us are subject to, and all of us have to cope with and deal with and respond to. And sickness, old age, and death, of course, is kind of shorthand in Buddhism for all the ways in which the world of impermanence, of change, causes suffering. And there's a lot of it. Some of you might know Margie Martis, who sat with us for many years. And she went to Europe this fall and got a cold, developed into a flu one day, all in the last day in Europe. And then was hospitalized and found out that she has pancreatic and liver cancer. And now she's getting hospice care at home, and all in a matter of a few weeks. And it's somewhat nice to think of the Buddha. It's a nice reminder. The Buddha was also subject to all these possibilities, all these things, and that he was trying to cope and trying to respond to this world of sickness, old age, and death. And he thought that there's something. Maybe I can find something which is deathless. Now, the deathless was in ancient India a very important concept, at least in the ancient Vedic literature. And the deathless. There was a discussion of the elixir of deathlessness, the nectar. There was an idea that if you can find some nectar of the gods, some kind of potion or something, or do some kind of ritual activities where you supplicate the gods, that you could become deathless yourself. You could never die. You could live eternally, eternal life. Many people in the world have sought such ideals. And it seems that in ancient Vedic religions, it was really kind of a literal idea that you'd become deathless. In the night of his enlightenment, the Buddha discovered the deathless. However, he himself was still subject to sickness, old age, and death. And after his enlightenment, there were times when he got sick. He certainly got old. There's even though most statues of the Buddha show him as a young, handsome man, a young man, youngish man. There's a descriptions in the discourses where he refers to himself as an old man, as someone whose face is covered with wrinkles and who is bent over, stooped over as he goes and walks around. So you expect, a Buddha to be someone who's radiant and shining and always 36 years old or whatever. But even a Buddha develops a face full of wrinkles and has trouble standing straight anymore. And then eventually he died. So the Buddha's discovery of the deathless did not mean that he was freed of sickness, old age, and death. So what was it he discovered? And I think what's happened here is that the Buddha translated or re-understood the concept of deathless as being something which is attainable, something right now, something that's available in the present moment, something that is perhaps always available. After his enlightenment, he announced, the doors of the deathless are open. So what is it that's always available right now? What are the doors that are always available right now that might have the quality of being deathless? So to understand that, maybe it's useful to look at what happened to the Buddha the night of his enlightenment. In the last watch of the night, the Buddha is said to have understood the Four Noble Truths. And in understanding the Four Noble Truths, he uprooted from his heart, from his mind, the three outflows. The three outflows is a Buddhist kind of terminological word. And the outflows, it means kind of the intoxicants of the mind, that which intoxicates the mind, the particular kind of grasping or clinging of the mind, which is a source of suffering. And if you can get rid of these three outflows, then suffering won't arise for you. And so the three particular outflows that the Buddha eliminated the night of his enlightenment was the outflow of clinging to sensual pleasure, the outflow of clinging to opinions, and the outflow of clinging to becoming, to identity. And I think what we have to do is to give this list the benefit of the doubt and understand that these somehow all clinging fits into these three categories. So you might ask yourself, you know, why were these so important categories? Why in the uprooting of these particular clingings did the Buddha discover the deathless? We can begin perhaps by looking at the sensual pleasure. It's very unpopular among people, especially Americans, to hear that the Buddha often gave discourses critical of attachment to sensual pleasure. And they think, oh, the Buddha, Buddhism is a downer of a religion. You know, they say, what's wrong with some sensual pleasure? It seems fine to be able to, you know, there's a lot of it, and it's easy to get here in our opulent society here in the West, and what's wrong with it? And, you know, some of us grew up in religious traditions which felt that sensual pleasure was a sin, and we rebelled against that, and we found that this Buddhism is supposed to be the opposite of that, and now the Buddha says too that you're not supposed to be attached to sensual pleasure, and, you know, maybe Sufi dancing is better. So the Buddha was specific in saying it was not sensual, it's not sensual pleasure which is the problem, but rather the attachment to it. And if we start investigating our relationship to sensual pleasure, to comfort, what you'll find, especially if the mind is very concentrated and very still, what you'll find is that sensual pleasure, attachment to it, underlies a tremendous amount of our motivation, our intentions, our desires, our clinging. Certainly there's obvious ways in which we're attached to sensual pleasure, but there's very subtle ways. And it's almost amoeba-like that the mind has a way of pulling away from anything which is uncomfortable and going towards that which is comfortable or pleasant. And that very simple movement of going towards and away is a genesis of a lot of grasping. What we find is that, certain amount of political philosophy, which can be quite elaborate and very developed and sophisticated, sometimes might have its genesis at someone's discomfort with being uncomfortable, or someone's desire for comfort. Our attachment to comfort and aversion to discomfort sometimes is masked by the complexity of what we're engaged in. But if you pay very careful attention, you can see you're pulling away from something which is uncomfortable. You meet a homeless person on the street, and it feels very unpleasant to meet that homeless person. And we pull away. But then we feel uncomfortable pulling away, and so then we want to develop a philosophy about why we shouldn't be involved with, be engaged with a homeless person. And it isn't that we have philosophical reasons originally, but rather we're justifying our discomfort and our pulling away. A lot of our decisions in life, I think, have a lot to do with the very simple movement of avoiding pleasure, avoiding discomfort, and wanting comfort. The way you come into a room to sit in a room, you might pay careful attention to see, how do you decide where you're going to sit in a room? Are you gravitating towards what's comfortable, or are you gravitating away from that which is unpleasant? Now, what's interesting about this movement towards pleasure and movement away from discomfort is that the mind is involved in an object when it's doing that. There's an object of pleasure, an object of discomfort. And so the mind is involved, is flowing out into some object, and it's engaged in it. As long as it's pulling away, as long as it's grasping at something, it's engaged in an object, in something. And that can be something external, flowing outwards. It can also flow inwards to inner pleasure or inner discomfort. But it's involved in an object. The second outflow is the outflow of opinions. Now, on the surface, this also can seem very obvious. I mean, we see people who are attached to their opinions all the time, and what a nuisance it is for us that they're attached to their opinions and they don't want to listen to ours. And it can cause a it's pretty obvious. You can read the newspapers and see pretty obviously the tremendous suffering that's caused around people's views and opinions. But I think if you pay very careful attention to how your mind works, you see that this is not just simply the surface of opinions, but goes much deeper. We have opinions or views about concepts and ideas of things. One of the opinions that we struggle with often is the opinion about ourselves, which may be better said, a concept of ourselves, some idea of who we are, or some idea of who we shouldn't be. When we're self-critical or ashamed of ourselves, we've grasped onto an opinion about who we are. If we think we're really great, and we go around with a swagger about how wonderful we are, we've grasped onto some opinion about who we are. And there's a lot of very subtle opinions. Some of these opinions about ourselves are acquired. And it's very hard to see how much they're acquired. Our families, growing up, can say very subtle things, maybe not so subtle, about who they think you are. And we just kind of take it to be a given. When you're 4 years old and someone tells you who you are, then you're not in the position to think things are any other way. So I remember there's one person who came to retreat and explained to me that his mother had periodically told him growing up that, you're a good boy, but not very bright. Now, he had no evidence to the contrary, so he took that on as being who he was. And he carried that around with him as an opinion. Or when I was in seventh grade, I had my first real art class, I think, and it was a lovely art class. I was drawing, and I think I was drawing my hand, and I noticed there's a lot of little lines on the hand. Nowadays it's wrinkles, but back then it was lines all over. And so I really got into it. I'll just be really realistic, and I'll draw all the little lines all over the hand, and I was drawing my hand. So it was got to be really messy. And the art teacher came over and said to me, you don't have any artistic talent. In seventh grade. So, she's the authority. So that must be the way it is. So that was an opinion, a view, a concept, that I wasn't exactly grasping onto it as because out of desire exactly, but I just kind of filed that away and kind of held on to that in the kind of way that whenever it came up some opportunity to do art again, oh, I remembered, oh yeah, I can't do that. And so the concepts, the opinions that we get attached to can be very subtle. They don't have to be, political opinions. They can be almost every week when I come here, I'm reminded that we're sitting on top of the San Andreas Fault. And I'm also reminded that that this floor is probably cement under here. It's quite hard. And then I know that if the San Andreas Fault decides to shake, this earth, this ground that we think is so solid and dependent on being so solid and expected to be so solid, can be like liquid suddenly. And so we might have a certain view that we're holding on to about what the nature of the ground is, but you better be careful when the earth starts shaking, take big steps over the cracks. So now again, what's interesting about this is when the mind is engaged in concepts and views, opinions that it's attached to, holding on to, the mind is engaged in objects, in something. There's mind is flowing out into an opinion and an idea. Then the third outflow is that of becoming, which in some ways closely related to the second one, Becoming is usually defined as the attachment to identity, to being, to creating, to being something, as opposed to just being in the abstract. It's being a thing. I have to be something. I have to create myself a certain way. I have to support myself. I have to support a certain identity, rather than just relaxing and being who I am. I think I've told this story a lot, but it's really wonderful to be around a person who no longer has to be anything for anybody, even for themselves. And the first person I had contact with that was like this was my great-grandmother. And I don't know what she was like when she was young, obviously, but you know, she had basically a relatively good conventional life. I think she had 8 kids, and they all outlived her, I believe. And she, you know, lived to be an old woman, and had done all the various things that in her society, in her time, she was supposed to do. And I would go visit her in her little room, and she was completely content with herself, at peace with herself. She wasn't attempting to be anything for anybody. She wasn't trying to impress herself or be someone special. There was a tremendous aura of peace that was there. She sat in her rocking chair. Now, again, when the mind flows out to becoming, to being an identity, again, the mind is engaged in an object, in something, some idea, some concept, some impulse of creativity, perhaps. So when the Buddha, night of his enlightenment, uprooted the 3 outflows, what he uprooted was the clinging, was the tendency to cling to things outside the mind, outside the heart, to flow out. Even if that flowing out is to the mind itself, to concepts, ideas in the mind, to flow up, flow out. And he discovered something that he called the deathless. So that leaves us again with the question, what is the deathless? And this is why it can be so challenging for us to be interested in it, because it does not belong to the world of objects. It has something to do with the mind, the awareness, the heart, the consciousness, when consciousness is not flowing out to an object. But the world that we negotiate, the world we have to kind of swim through and make a living in and go shopping in and relate to and all that, is all a world of objects. For most of us, it's all we know. All we ever relate to is a world of objects. And and because we don't know there's any alternative, we just engage with great enthusiasm, with great, you know, whatever. And what the Buddha was saying is that if you can turn the mind around and be willing, at least temporarily, to let go of your interest in the objects of the world and focus on the mind itself, consciousness itself, you'll discover something about consciousness where it's free of all conventions. And so it was called that, the unconventional reality, or the usual way in English is to call it the unconditioned, the unfabricated, the unformed. Something which is not shaped by objects. Analogy that might work for this is that of ice. Say you're a ice artist, you like to sculpt ice, and you go out and find big blocks of ice, and you sculpt it, and you look at it and you have this wonderful sculpture, and you say, well, that's nice, but now I'd like to, you sculpted a bust, and so then you say, well, that's nice, but now I think what I want to do is I'll sculpt a polar bear. So you kind of, well, I only have this one block of ice, so then I'll try to sculpt that polar bear. And each time you sculpt it, the different object becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, because you're chipping it away. But then one day you discover that the nature of ice is to be water. And what you can do is you can just melt the ice block and then put it back in whatever form or shape that you want, and it can re-solidify into some new object. And it's a lot easier to melt the ice and return to its flowing nature and then reshape it by putting it back in the into some kind of ice cube tray and then refreeze it than it is to always be sculpting ice and starting only with ice and changing ice. So the mind is the same way. When the mind is involved in objects, the mind can be kind of frozen. And sometimes it's dramatically frozen in some preoccupation, some fear, some grief, some regret, or whatever. But if you have some sense of the possibility of the mind becoming fluid, or the mind not being, or the mind being unshaped, of allowing the mind to return to its water nature, where it doesn't have any shape at all, then it's, you can use it then to shape it in all kinds of ways, in a fluid way. Or maybe this is another analogy that maybe works. Say you're always interested in getting somewhere. Your whole life is about getting somewhere. Walking, running, taking your car, taking boats, biking. You're always getting, going somewhere. That's great, right? So that's what you think life's all about. And so but then you're walking along, and you come to this big body of water, and the only way to get across is to swim. But you don't know how to swim. So you say, well, I have to learn how to swim. And so you go take swimming lessons. And the person says, well, first thing you have to learn before you can learn to swim is learn how to float. And you say, float has no practical value. I'm trying to get somewhere. What, do you just float and do nothing and not try to go anywhere at all? Why should I do that? Teach me how to swim so I can get somewhere. And if you insist on always getting somewhere without learning to float, floating you don't get anywhere, right? You just lay there, you're just bobbing up and down. But if you're so obsessed with always getting somewhere, you might not see the value of floating. So the unconventional mind, the mind which is unshaped, the mind which is not relating to objects, is kind of like the mind floating. And it's very important to be able to learn how to float so you can learn how to walk. Or swim, or whatever we do, swim, I guess, in a useful way. So the mind which is unshaped and unformed. And now if you start paying careful attention to your mind and how it works, you'll find that it's constantly involved in objects, in concerns, in preoccupations. And it can seem inconceivable that there could be any alternative, that the mind can be involved in something else. However, as you do mindfulness practice, and mindfulness practice is a practice of simply paying attention to what's going on in the present moment, and a lot of what we're paying attention to is the objects of attention, what happens is the mindfulness itself, the mind itself becomes stronger. The mindfulness itself is kind of like a muscle that gets stronger and stronger, or it's like a light bulb that begins to glow brighter and brighter. And at some point, in the beginning, you're mostly focusing on the object, on your breath, on the body sensations, on feelings, on sounds, whatever you're paying attention to. But if you can train yourself to be mindful without getting caught up in what you're paying attention to. So you're paying careful attention to things, but you're not obsessing with it, you're not preoccupied with it, not trying to manipulate it or change it or hold on to it or resist it, but just simply to look at it carefully for what it is. Then the mindfulness becomes stronger. And as the mindfulness becomes stronger and stronger and stronger, you get a sense that there's a part of the mind which is unshaped by the objects that it pays attention to. It's as if your ability to pay attention has become so big that it has room for everything within it without being preoccupied or concerned about what's in the room. If you're in a small elevator with a couple of people, you might feel claustrophobic. But if those same couple of people are in this big room here, you won't feel so claustrophobic because there's lots of room and you're kind of much more spacious about them being here. So as the mindfulness gets stronger, it's kind of like it gets more spacious, more and more room. And then, at some point, you can turn your attention around and notice that it's the nature of awareness to be unshaped, to be unformed, to be unconventional. There's something about the nature of awareness itself, that awareness itself can exist without always judging or preoccupied or holding on or engaging in the objects of the world. So the Buddha said in one famous verse, attentiveness is the path of the deathless. Inattention is the path of death. The inattentive are as if already dead. The attentive will never die. Something about attentiveness, something about the nature of awareness, alertness, something about the nature of being present, has the quality of deathlessness. So the deathless is not something which is in the future. It's not something which is far away from you today. But rather, it's something about the nature of your own consciousness, your own awareness. And so, what is that? What is it that's available right now for each of you in your awareness, in the awareness that listens to me speak, in the awareness that reflects on what I'm talking about, reacts to it, in the awareness of what's happening in your body? Is there something in that awareness which is unshaped, unformed, unconventional? Is there something in that awareness which can exist independent of the objects of that awareness? Is there something in your present moment awareness which is the deathless, the doors to the deathless? The deathless, I think, is kind of an Indian concept. We don't necessarily use it so much here in the West. A concept that's used much more in the West is the notion of timelessness, the timeless present. There's something about the present that if you just kind of rest in the present, it has kind of a timeless quality. And that timeless, eternal quality of the present is the same timeless present that existed for the Buddha when he was alive. The timeless present never changes. We partake in the same timeless present as the Buddha did, as other enlightened people did, as all people before us have been part and lived in the same timeless present. And so what is that sense of presence? What is a sense of consciousness, awareness, which can have the feeling of being timeless? Maybe some of you have had that taste of that. And if you think back at that, or next time it happens, if you kind of pay attention to that, you probably notice that the mind is very spacious and the mind is not constricted around objects, about things, what it wants. And objects, of course, can mean people too. And paradoxically, what keeps us at a distance from people in time is our fixation on notions of time, notions of past, notions of them. That in the timeless presence, there's no distance between us and anyone else. And that's why many, number of enlightened people that I've known, when they were on their deathbed, have said things like, I'm not going anywhere, or I'll always be with you. The timeless quality of the mind is always here. Or maybe it's better to say, seems like it's always here. The mind, the pure nature of consciousness is experienced as if it is deathless, as if it is timeless. Some people will take a metaphysical step and say that it is deathless. It means actually consciousness never, you know, always has been and always will be. But I think that's taking a step too far. What we can say is that consciousness has the quality to seem as if it's deathless, to seem as if it will never die, to seem as if it's timeless. Whether it is or not is less important than if you have a very solid taste of the deathless. Then you'll see that there's an alternative to the usual way in which we live our lives with our minds. to always be caught up in objects, in outflows. The mind is flowing out to things. And then we can have a very different relationship to all the things the mind flows out to. And we don't have to reject it or turn away from those things, but it's kind of like we hold it much more lightly. We don't take it quite as a burden for the mind. What it means is that we have some sense of some security, which is outside of all the conventional sources of security. It means that we have some sense that there's an alternative than there's an alternative to all the normal ways in which people seek for happiness. The deathless is considered, also called the great happiness, the Mahasukha. Because the deathless is there, whether you're employed or unemployed, whether you're healthy or in ill health, whether you're in a relationship or not in a relationship, whether you have money in your bank account or you don't have money in your bank account. The deathless, that quality is always there. It doesn't depend on quality of life kind of issues. If we're always involved with quality of life, some people are lucky and be able to kind of maintain a good quality until the day they die, but some people can't. You know, Marjorie, her illness came quite out of the blue for her. So if we're always spend our whole life thinking life is only about adjusting the quality of life issues or finding security in all these things which are possibly can change, then when the quality of life, the objects that provide the quality of life disappear, we're left in distress. But if we know something unshakable, some unshakable quality of the heart, of the mind, of consciousness, which is always here and always present, which does not partake of all the things in the world, then I think we can be much more gracious about how we manage our life. So I wish you all a happy new year, and I hope that you now will use this wonderful convention of New Year's lightly, not take it too seriously, and use it as a reminder that perhaps the deathless quality of time that exists at midnight of New Year's Eve, where nothing actually happens, is a reminder that you don't have to look always to the time that the calendar tells us is happening, but rather we can turn away from the calendar time and look into the timelessness of what's happening right now. And since I've managed to talk with conventionally 3 minutes left, any comments, questions? Yes.
You described the state of your grandmother or your great grandmother. I can't remember, but and I'm wondering, do you think that it's possible to achieve that and still like be functional, like in the work world? And I mean, or is that something that just comes with old age, and eventually we can get there and we just work at it all our lives? Or is it possible to really not have those senses of connections and living in roles and identities, and still be, you know, in kind of the lives that we?
Well, this is where I'm very unsure about how I should answer, because if I say that it's very hard to function in the world, then people say, well, forget that. Who wants that then? Because I function in the world, you know. That's where we think everything's at. So, I don't know.
That's a fair answer.
There is a... some folk wisdom, and it doesn't seem to be coming from the Buddha, but there's, I guess, a kind of a little tradition in Theravadan Buddhism that when a person becomes fully liberated, as opposed to partially liberated, that the person better become a monastic within 7 days. Otherwise, they'll die. So that was a very strange teaching, kind of pro-monastic kind of teaching. But I understood it a little bit differently when I went traveling in India. I was really struck when I was traveling in India how there were how much demands there were on me all the time. Just walking down the street, there were always people who wanted something from me, who wanted some, basically my money. But you know, it was kind of, there's always people kind of crawling after me, wanting things and wanting to take advantage of me and somehow get me to part with my money, whether legally or illegally. And I thought, well, if a person was fully liberated, they are incapable of lying, incapable of bargaining, incapable of